Okay, yeah, that was fine.
Okay, good. All right. Get my notepad out. So, did you have a chance to look at the new stuff?
Yeah, I did. I looked I looked through basically the more or less all of the whole site.
Oh, is it okay by you if I is it okay by you if I record this call? I mean, we wouldn't publish anything
Sure.
without running it by you, but okay, thanks.
Sure.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, continue.
Oh yeah, so I have had a chance to look at it. I was just saying.
Okay, so maybe we should just start. I mean, before I ask anything specific, just what were your general thoughts on what were our approach and what we're concluding?
It's hard to say. I think I was most I guess I'm personally most curious about the two general areas that you have, which is one is saving lives and health, and the other is poverty. And I've been really interested in what organizations are out there doing something, for example, like providing what's to me seems like the most obvious thing to do on the ground, which is primary care. So it's not,
Right.
necessarily just, bed nets or HIV treatment, but it's something like, you're in a community, so you provide the care that's necessary, which usually is a little bit of everything, to the people who need it.
Well, we're not
And
doing,
so,
I should clarify, I mean, we're not like that's a year one thing, that sort of the split into two causes. We're not really on that anymore.
okay.
We're doing developing world aid in general, and we're open to primary care. So, I mean, the stuff that was new, to be clear, is mostly the Carter Center review. Did you get a chance
Right.
to look at that?
I did, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean,
Yeah, that's good.
we didn't pick them specifically because of their health or anything. We basically,
Right.
it's kind of weird, but we basically took the Carter Center and noticed that they looked like a really transparent organization. They were doing good programs that, have good track records. They themselves have a good track record. They're, credited as one of those big global health success stories with the near eradication of guinea worm. And,
Right.
so we thought they were worth investigation. And after looking at them after putting quite a bit of effort into them, concluded that they had some programs that looked really strong and really transparent, and other programs
Right.
very difficult to tell what they're accomplishing, if anything, and without knowing how much. What their allocation is between the different programs, it ends up being very hard to evaluate them, so.
Right. Yeah, I guess I should say first, that it is really nice going through, I do go through your website every once in a while, but it's always nice. Even it's on one hand, it's really what's amazingly clear is, at some level, the dearth of really good information on the effectiveness of everything. But on the other level, it's just nice if, for what you all do. Just having something of a clearinghouse of documents, of some kind of analysis, maybe some really rough estimate of, how much it costs to save a life or something like that. Maybe like I personally don't know how much to weigh those kinds of estimates, but just the overall sort of like clearinghouse phenomena where there's at least one place one can go to where they can just kind of sort through things and see what people are doing. That alone, I think, is probably quite nicer. I wonder if I was thinking how this would have been the kind of resource that would have been nice when I was kickstarting my dissertation, like 9 years ago. And I wonder, do you ever have any students, dissertation type students, economic students, health economic students, those types come through and say, hey, I'd like to sort of like dig a little deeper into some of these leads.
We have people of that profile sometimes, offer to volunteer for us and stuff. I haven't had a lot of, well, I need help with my paper, can you help me with this or that? I haven't had that. I mean, I think it certainly seems to me like there's not a lot of research on charity, which is kind of what we're about in the first place, you know what I'm saying? Like there's a lot of research on aid, But when you read it, it turns out that aid means official aid. And as far as, you know, what does Save the Children do, and how does it compare to what UNICEF does? I mean, there's nothing in that. There's some, but very little.
Right. Yeah. So when you for the Carter Center, for example, another thing that struck me is I hadn't seen those numbers before, I guess, on the effectiveness of the eradication of guinea worm, and so it looks like what you all did is took the essentially their total expenditures on the project and divided by some estimate of the number of cases averted over that period, and sort of which I obviously is like as good a measure as any. Is your goal to like evaluate sort of retrospectively, you know, historically, sort of the impact of their program, or is it, you know, if I want to give the Carter Center $100, you know, what do I think the impact would be? Because if it was the latter, then maybe, you know, I'd wonder, well, it looks like there's not that much guinea worm anymore. And
yeah, I think it's a fair point. I mean, the goal is more the second one. And the thing is that we just, these cost effectiveness estimates, they're so rough and they're so difficult and they eat up so much time that we generally, like, our approach to cost effectiveness is like, whatever we can do, let's do it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Sure. And so.
Sure. Yeah, it's good.
And so basically, you know, we say in the thing what it is, what the guinea worm cost estimate is. We say, it's hard to estimate the impact going forward. We're going to estimate the impact it's had to date. It's to give a general sense of the Carter Center, too. Like, you know, if you could look at all their activities and see, well, guinea worms are the kind of thing they poured a lot into in the past. This is how it's been. But I also think it's a fair point that they're going to spend a lot of money on guinea worm going forward, and it wouldn't be the same, you know, it wouldn't be the same number. And it might be worth changing that summary table to reflect that.
Yeah. No, I mean not. I mean, I'm not criticizing it. I was just sort of. I think it's as good a method as any that you're doing.
Good. Okay.
But I don't have any visceral sort of emotional reaction except for just the overall feeling of how you know, when you come away with this after all this work that you all do. There are certain organizations that, you know, that if nothing else have a clear mission, and you know, have seem to spend their money pretty well, seem to know what they're doing, and seem to be, you know, not especially wasteful, and the mission's a good one, and then have some numbers to show for it, and that's worth a lot. I mean, for me, I just it's so hard to really, you know, as someone who works sort of in this kind of primary healthcare system, when you see the complex of ailments and ways that money is spent and how to measure that, it's just, it does always strike me how hard it is to really get a perfect sense of the impact of a dollar spent. But still, it's nice to see what you all do.
Yeah, we've been trying to spend less time and emphasis on those cost-effectiveness estimates because we know how imprecise they are. We know how problematic they are. We don't want to leave them out because we want to give people something to latch onto and put it in context against their other options. And so, you know, things that are anywhere in the same range, I think you should decide using other factors. But at the same time, it matters a lot what you can get in developing world aid versus, you know, U.S. causes, that kind of comparison.
Right.
A lot of matters.
Right.
And it's just to make things more concrete. And I honestly think even in developing world aid, like Partners in Health, I have no idea if our estimate was somewhat, you know, weird the way we did theirs. I think it's, you know, the best we could do. I think it's the best estimate I've got. But I think it's logical. You know, Partners in Health spends a lot of money on the most expensive ways of helping people within developing world health, and it's worth noting. It doesn't mean it's a bad thing. You might believe in the mission of universal care and whatever it costs, but it seems like it is important, you know. And I think our numbers do capture. You get like a factor of four difference in cost effectiveness between them and some of these
right
guys.
Sure.
And hey, I think that's accurate in spirit. I don't know if it's 4 or 10 or 2, but there's got to be a difference because of the way that they're not making that trade-off, you know. And Partners in Health is explicit about that they're not really trying to be cost-effective necessarily. Mm-hmm. So I think that kind of thing is worth noting. It has some validity.
Yeah, they're not. It's funny. They're not exactly trying to be, in a sense, you know, PIH doesn't do that kind of calculus, but it's sort of like I've been really interested in something really soft phenomenon in terms of how one thinks about the sort of the projects at which we support, which is sort of the overall cost of primary care is really low, you know, by any standard, I would say, which is about, you know, less than $30 per person annually, you know. And so that's even with, you know, HIV and TB treatment, which is relatively expensive. And then that, and the effectiveness of that becomes pretty pretty great, which is that, you know, you're offering things like HIV and TB treatment in addition to all this, you know, community health worker access and everything else. And there's something about what I think is really interesting in terms of the synergy of investing a lot in some programs, sort of like, you know, save them at all costs. It just becomes a really effective environment to work in. So people work a lot harder, you know.
Yeah.
They're, you know, they really believe even the mission of what you're doing. And so the overall efficiency, the overall cost effectiveness of saving lives at all costs, I think it can be surprisingly probably much better than what might be doing if you're just trying to sort of isolate certain things.
I agree. It's better than what you would expect, and it might be better than a lot of other charitable options. I also, you know, I mean, $30 per patient, okay, but you know, a lot of these neglected tropical disease things, it's like $5 to $10 or less per right. person treated. They only need one treatment per year. You know, so I think it's. I think there's a difference. I think Partners in Health is comfortable with that difference. They choose to accept that difference. Right. And they choose to go after a certain thing. You know, there's advantages, I think, for sure, to the kind of community approach. But I also think there is a cost-effectiveness difference. I don't think it should just be waved away. I think...
To be honest, I honestly doubt it. Like, you know, if you spend $5 or $10 per treatment for some kind of neglected tropical disease, that's already, you know, one third or one sixth of the total cost of of the full range of primary care options for a primary, you know, that we would do, you know, which would include something like, you know, deworming programs and things like that, you know, because we already have the institutions on the ground, so servicing them becomes a little bit lower cost per person. And so, you know, for a primary care thing that costs $30 per person per year, you get the deworming and the treatment of neglected tropical, you know, other neglected tropical diseases.
Isn't that $30? Maybe I'm misremembering this number. I thought that number, like $30 per person per year, I thought that was like for every person who like lives in the area, whether or not they even come in for primary care that year.
That's true. But the average person comes in about, you're right, the average person probably comes in about, you know, something like 1 to 2 times per year to a health center.
And for what, that's though? And you know, and oftentimes for something less severe than what, you know, what the disease is you're trying to prevent with the annual drug treatment. So that's...
Yeah.
You know, I'm not trying to disparage the work.
Sure.
It's just when I think about which is more cost-effective, it just seems like, you know, pick one real severe disease, you go to an area where it's endemic, almost everyone is at risk from it. You administer an extremely cheap drug that only has to be given once a year and you get out, versus, you know, you set up this thing that gives everything to everyone. And again, I think there's good reasons to be the second one, but I think that in that trade-off, to me, my guess is that it's more expensive, and that's okay, you know, that should be.
Right.
I don't know. I mean, it's debatable, obviously.
Okay.
The numbers are tough, so, but that from what I know, that's what I would guess, and that is what a lot of people. I'm not alone here, you know, that most of these estimates are even our estimates. They're experts' estimates.
Right.
Experts make the same points we're making.
Sure.
So anyway, just going back to going back to the work we've been doing, I mean, I guess I'd like to get, I mean, what is your sense on the Carter Center? Like, would you, you know, putting aside sort of Partners in Health and Lenny, we'll get to it. I mean, would you
sure. Sure, let me go back to that. Let's pull it open. Yeah, I don't have any, you know, stronger reactions. I guess, you know, I was noticing what you all pointed out, which was that their revenues are a lot higher than their expenses. Is that right? Let me just pull that back up. And I, you know, in, again, just purely and instinctively, when I think of something like the Carter Center, I just imagine sort of this really big, sort of bulk, kind of awkward, slightly awkward institution that ultimately has a clear mission and does a good job, but has like a lot of overhead and all that stuff. But that's not what your numbers say.
No.
But I was curious about what
that
what
was
you
your
made
impression
of
the Carter Center. Sorry.
No, that wasn't my impression from what you all wrote. That was just sort of my instinct. I said, oh, they're probably going to be a really big, bulky organization that ultimately does a good job at what they do. But, you know, in the context of, you know, sort of the awkwardness of a lot of overhead and what happens when an organization gets to a certain scale. But then, no, that it wasn't my impression from the numbers that you,
right,
you made, except for the one observation that, what did you make of the total revenues being so much greater than, the expenses? Is that right? Were they much greater than the expenses?
Yeah, they are.
Yeah.
Well,
I mean, what's up with that?
They may be planning to expand. I know that they have this BedNet program that, they're planning to expand. I also think it's possible that they just, you know, whatever. They're just amazing at fundraising and that's about it. It's a recent thing. In the last 5 years that the revenues are, well, I guess before that too. There was this little period.
Right.
I mean, it's more, there's more volatility here than you see in most charities this size. I mean, with the, you know, expenses going up and down and the revenues going up and down. So I don't know. We may want to break those into sources.
I'm always kind of blown away when an organization like that is able to raise. It's an impressive amount of, just revenues in generally. I'm just impressed with being able to raise, you know, $120 million in a year, and you know they obviously have the mission that they have. I don't really when I look through the program that you have, the programs that you guys describe, I don't have maybe if I looked harder I would have noticed it, but I don't have a clear sense of sort of how that works. Is it they fly into an area and then set up some, you know, tents or work within the health system and then start distributing pills, or are they like a permanent presence on the ground in like, you know, 30 different countries or so I don't personally have a good feel for sort of what the day-to-day life is at a place like the Carter Center. But obviously, what the numbers that you all crank out are great. I mean, obviously, all these neglected tropical diseases are wonderful, and other diseases that aren't so neglected, like malaria, those programs are also obviously important.
Yeah. Well, I think, it's program by program is the answer, right? And I think most of these programs, they do not have a permanent presence, but we generally, I think we describe what they do. Maybe not. I'm looking at it here.
Let's see.
Well, it says for river blindness program, they follow the community-directed treatment with ivermectin process. You know, I mean, these are all, most of these programs are like annual distribution of drugs.
Right.
I mean, guinea worm is going to be different. So it describes pretty clearly what they do for guinea worm.
Oh, I see. I'm opening some links that I hadn't opened before. Wow.
Oh, you hadn't clicked on the program detail link?
Well, right now I'm looking at this this river blindness program. Yeah, that I hadn't opened before. Yeah. Those numbers are just great, aren't they?
The cost effectiveness?
And just the effectiveness of the impact on the prevalence.
Yeah.
That stuff is really sweet, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's amazing. So that's kind of really nice. It's sort of like, I don't know what their criterion or how they pick their diseases, but it's like, yeah, they're going after diseases that are obviously, that are both really bad and that you really can do something about fairly quickly and to the point where you can actually get eradication,
right.
Which is really good. So not only are you saving individual lives, but you can imagine what you can imagine how much you underestimate for
Absolutely.
All the transmission that would be happening, you know, interannually. So then it becomes like a lot of the cause effectiveness becomes pretty phenomenal.
Right, it does. I mean,
once
the estimates we use are based on, you know, scholars' estimates, so they're not. I mean, they are trying to take into account the sort of slowing of transmission, but they're not assuming eradication. I mean, if you achieve eradication, then those numbers skyrocket.
Yeah. And why is it that you associate so much of the change in these prevalences to the Carter Center? Are other organizations are they pretty much the major entity that are in these areas fighting these diseases like river blindness? Or is this part of an integrated campaign with the World Health Organization or something, a UN organization or something?
It is definitely part of an integrated campaign, and that's one of the things that we've really struggled with, is, you know, we don't really know how to tease that out. We have something we're working on now, actually, which you might be able to help with in terms of making the right connections, where we're trying to, like, pick a project. Actually, an onchocerciasis control project, although not in the Carter Center area. Basically, get in contact with the WHO, which runs the onchocerciasis control program. Get in touch with the NGO on the ground. Get in touch with the government. I'm trying to talk to one person from each organization who's worked on the ground and ask them, you know, what were the other guys doing? What did you see? I mean, it's not the Carter Center, but what did you see from the NGO? What was your experience with them? What role did they play? And get everyone's perspective on everyone else, because that is a really tough thing.
Right.
You know, to date, we haven't dealt with that question. What we've done instead is we've said, look, Carter Center is clearly, you know, a major part of this campaign. They're spending, you know, a good deal of money. They're putting in a good deal of work. They're the NGO partner on the ground in these areas. If we can find charities where everything they do is work on campaigns that are going well, yeah, in theory, they could just be like a piggyback leech type organization, but most likely you give them more money, and what it means is somehow more of this good stuff is going to get done. So, you know, that's kind of our assumption.
Would it make sense to take the total expenditures on, you know, river blindness and lymphatic filariasis and those kinds of things in those areas and add them all up, or to sort of get an overall sense of what maybe the cost effectiveness
I think we have like one chart on that for the Carter Center that had Carter Center being a pretty significant part, but I could be wrong about that. And generally, I think what you're saying is sound, except that you often can't get the data. So our biggest frustration with Carter Center is that there's no cost data, that you can look at their audited financial statement. But other than that, you cannot see how much they spent in an area or on a program. And that kills us. You know, we don't know what to do with that. We've got an organization that, seems to run a lot of good programs, also runs a lot of programs that I personally have no confidence in. And we don't know how much is being spent where.
Right.
So that really bugs us. And it's ultimately why I wouldn't bet on the Carter Center. And I have a much easier time with some of these simpler organizations that, you know, I know exactly what they do, and I don't have to sit here worrying about, well, how much is going to the good programs and how much is going to the bad programs, or at least the very unclear programs, like the agriculture thing that Carter Center does.
Right. As you're talking, I'm opening these the more click here things in case there was stuff that I didn't see.
Yeah, you if know, you want to take 5 minutes or 10 minutes to look at that and get
no,
that.
Yeah, I just have. I mean, it was just a river blindness program that I hadn't seen, which is so kind of a neat, kind of a nice presentation. So they provide all that information, I gather, or those aren't your graphs.
We made the graphs, but they provide all that information. Yeah. It's
oh,
not
really?
Presented.
Nice.
It's not presented in the you know, in an easy to see way. They have a lot of reports. They say this happened here and that happened there. So, you know, we had like an assistant collect it all and then we turned it into graphs.
I see.
But the info, yeah, obviously they're providing all the info. We didn't go to those areas and monitor on coastal caddis prevalence.
It's so hard, you know, to be honest. No, I have two sort of general feelings when I see these numbers. On the one hand, I feel like the first thing I think is, you know, a cause like fighting river blindness is a really effective thing to have been getting involved with, because it really is, you know, you can knock it out. Which is also true, of course, for like, you know, helminth infections like hookworm and stuff. You can, with a good campaign, you can really knock them out. So that is great. And I guess, you know, when you look at these numbers, it probably makes sense that to think of these things as being, you know, really mostly associated with the one program. I mean, my first instinct was, God, it's so hard to tell exactly what's going on in these areas, but
yeah.
I guess realistically, it sounds like you have good reason to associate these results with their efforts.
I think so. I mean, you know, it could be, the case could be stronger than it is. They could have done a, you know, baseline survey prior to entering the area, and you could see some shape of the line before they moved in. I really wish they had, but I mean, I mostly agree with you.
Right.
That's where I would bet.
Yeah.
So, can I ask a little more about your prior impression of Carter Center and where that comes from? What's that based on? Is that kind of what you would think of any large organization?
Yeah, it has nothing to do with them. I guess, to be honest, it's really just a kind of an unfortunate skepticism. It has something to do with the fact that they are in, they operate out of Emory University, right?
Yeah.
Do they?
Yes.
Sorry. Okay. And, you know, it's really just because, I think it's just because I tend to see so many organizations that seem to struggle, especially those just really large ones that can be in universities or, you know, big international NGOs or any one of those sort of, it becomes like this, a scale phenomenon, I guess, where at some level things just stop working very well, and monitoring, you know, just the number of layers to accomplishing a mission becomes really high. But it's really just because I've just seen so many not so great NGOs, that's all.
Would you mind elaborating on that, or is that something you can't do?
What's that?
Would you mind elaborating on that, or, you know, on the things you've seen that are bad? We don't hear enough of these stories, because whenever something's not going well, a nonprofit will just report nothing, and then the question is, are we just fetishizing reporting? And so, you know, we really want more info about the things that aren't going so well.
Right. Well, I guess I should probably start by not talking about the organization. Like, I probably shouldn't talk about, I'd rather not talk about the organizations that I've worked for. though I could tell you that I think PIH is a really, really effective organization, but, you know, I live in Rwanda, and I'm kind of engaged in a pretty big community of people who are involved with all kinds of organizations that can be conservation-oriented or health-oriented or education-oriented or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I would say that one observation that I've had, and that, you know, I kind of we share with, you know, friends of mine in the same world, is sort of marveling at how, I guess you would call it, I don't know what you call it, mission creep or lack of focus or whatever, from projects that tend to be started in abroad, for example, Atlanta, you know, and then and are sort of dreamed up from far away, and even with a pretty coherent idea, but then slowly the process of like of getting people on the ground and being really effective at getting people on the ground and getting communities and governments on board or whatever it would be to get like the sort of buy-in that would be necessary, for example, to distribute a bunch of treatments for a disease or something like that, that becomes a process that my own observation is seems to be that there becomes such a detachment that that becomes even just almost psychological. Like I felt that way living in New York before, working with the Millennium Villages Project. You know, you just feel so detached from what's happening. And you can see that detachment kind of manifest in organizations that are older, and it seems to me the bigger and older the organization is, and the further away it is, the weirder the activities on the ground might be.
Okay.
It's kind of conventional wisdom, I would say.
Right. Well, I agree with that.
Yeah.
I mean, what I want to hear about, if you're willing to share, even without naming names, is that weirdness. I mean, I understand the conceptual dynamic that you're far away, you know, you're planning these things and, you know, you're really big and bureaucratic and they come out weird. So what's the weirdness? What's it look like to you on the ground? What are the failures and the bad stuff? What does it look like?
Right. Let me think about. The only reason I'm hesitating is just because, you know, I don't really want to name names because I do live, you know, these are people. I have friends and colleagues who work for organizations that I think have lost a lot of sight for what they're doing, and I'd rather.
But you understand where we're coming from, right? That, you know,
on one hand, definitely.
It's just this difficult situation where on one hand, everyone we talk to, like you, says, there's lots of bad stuff happening, but I don't want to name names because I've, you know, got these friends. but then we come along and we're trying to help donors, and the donors say, you know, why are you guys so into measurement? Why can't I just give to Save the Children? And we say, well, things could be going really wrong. And they're like, do you have examples? And we're like, well, not as many as we could because nobody ever talks about this stuff. And so the donors, you know, the donors in America who are totally removed from everything just have no sense of what's going on and are removed because no one can share with them. No one can be honest with them about the failures because no one wants to name names. So I'm trying to find a way between that.
Yeah.
You know, one way
would
be for you to talk to us about things in terms of organization.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's the whole point of what you all are doing, I think.
Right.
I mean, to me, that's the whole point is sort of giving, you know, providing some light on let me think.
But you don't have to name, if you don't want to name specific organizations and you want to say organization A, organization B, then that's somewhat of a compromise, you know?
Right. I can think of an organization here in Rwanda that has a headquarters in the United States that has a mission to has a couple different things, but for example they have a health clinic, right? And what I've personally seen is that the country director gets involved in a number of different endeavors, tries to spend a lot of time raising funds, and hasn't visited the health clinic in like a year, literally a year. Not because he's on vacation, but because, you know, he's drawing up funds, he's writing stuff, he's working on, you know, various other kinds of projects. And that's with having a country director here. And so then what happens is sort of something from the U.S., a particular mission, there just becomes this complete, like, a lack of some sort of dynamic feedback where, you know, what's happening on the ground gets to the U.S., that gets processed and then adapted and then you know, the mission gets adapt it. I'm trying to think of a concrete example.
Yeah, I mean, how does that translate?
The way it manifests is a lot of workers who complain a lot about sort of not being able to do X, Y, or Z, or feeling like their hands are tied, or not being able to sort of, you know, treat people for one thing or another. But and so it manifests in like a low morale. That's what like I can observe. I'm sorry. I'm not trying to be, you know, evasive. I'm just trying to think of something. I'm trying to think of something really concrete. Now, I'll give you an example. This is not a very good example for you analyzing, you know, big organizations, but an example of something that I feel like I've faced just with my own work that I felt like required a lot of being in tune with what's going on here. So one thing that we're doing is I'm doing some economics research, you know, and in addition to other stuff, I'm looking at, you know, what the impact of the health system is on the local economy. So mm-hmm. we are, like, monitoring local businesses. We're GIS mapping them. We're trying to measure how much revenue they're making. We're taking photographs of the businesses. We're doing everything. So we're trying to map the whole economy as best as we can, the whole formal economy as best we can, figure out how much taxes they have and stuff. And the process takes a really long time. So it's like... I expected to have so much done by now, but what happens is first you have to, you know, come up with a committee that represents the community, and the committee people want to meet a bunch of times, and then you have to meet with like the sector leaders and the mayors, and the sector leaders are going to introduce this to all the people, and like the number of steps that you have to take to get buy-in, you know, becomes really significant, because like the community really needs to get what you're doing. You know, and that slow kind of methodical process that requires like a day-to-day interaction, you know, has been really illuminating for me. It's much better. So now when we go to businesses, we ask them questions, they give us answers, and they say, oh, hi, you know, we met you before at that meeting. And they seem to be very cooperative. And we seem to think that the data we're getting, which has been, we were told by the business committees themselves that this is the data people provide, and then we introduce it. We think everything is working well, and it's taken a really long time. But my instinct was, well, can't we just, like, do we really have to have all these meetings? This is going to take months. It's going to be such a long process. Can't we just, you know, start executing the survey? Uh-huh. You know? And so, which is what happens when, you know, I've seen, you know, an organization like in the U.S. is trying to do something, is they say, okay, just... you know, just collect this data. Just go out there and, you know, report back to us. And especially if, for example, a survey was designed from the United States that wasn't adapted by the community members themselves, then you have no idea whether people are going to comply. You know, it just, like, this kind of, this like, really slow process of just having the community absorb, you know, what you do seems so... So like, I've personally felt that, and I've noticed, and as long as the headquarters sort of understands that process, is responding to that process, and is really offers more of a support system, that's like how I feel like PIH operates for the people on the ground. It can be really effective. But I guess I feel like this kind of I can see how if I were implementing, for example, a survey that was drafted in the United States, then it just wouldn't work at all. You know, the community says, well, we would have to help design that. And I guess I could say that I've been part of processes like that where we went about it wrong, and I think the data came out wrong, you know, for other organizations I've worked for. So I felt that personally things go wrong from just the lack of sort of in tuneness, you know, and having like that. But and I have really good friends. Let me give you another good example. Example just crossed my mind. I have a friend who runs a small NGO here, a good friend of mine in the U.S. runs a small organization here in Rwanda. They are building an eco lodge. hear me? I don't know if you're still
there. Yeah, I can hear you. Yep.
Okay. Sorry. This is they have an organization. They're building an eco lodge. They provide like they built a nursery school, provided a clinic, those kinds of things, in a village here in Rwanda. Mm-hmm. And the Eco Lodge is supposed to generate revenue to, like, pay for all of these things, you know, ultimately. They're going to make some profits. They're going to use the profits to fund, you know, to adopt a bunch of children, you know, for kids, orphan kids, as well as, you know, pay for school expenses, as well as pay for a hydrology project, all this kind of stuff.
Uh-huh.
But this particular friend, who's like a dear friend of mine, actually, has been to this village maybe, say, three times. He worked really, really hard, very, very hard, in New York, trying to raise money, you know, trying to dream of, you know, how this can work, trying to manage staff and stuff from a couple different countries. But they picked a site for the Eco Lodge that's probably, in my opinion, too steep. And the architects designed the Eco Lodge, which is supposed to be like a $500 a night type site, out of New York, totally sort of independent of the specific elevation or the specific gradient of the hill that it's going on, and totally out of touch with exactly, you know, what the view would be or whatever to maximize the money that they could get. And and they do have people on the ground reporting back saying, you know, I think we should have the architects come here and, you know, see the site, for example, before they design this. And the same architects, you know, designed the health center, and were insistent, for example, that the land around it were not used at right angles to the health center.
Right.
And so, you know, which we wanted to use, not we, people, friends of mine, wanted to use for an agricultural training program, but they didn't. So, like, there's this kind of, you see it, and every organization, every single one who has a foreign headquarters deals with this regularly, trying to, well, on the one hand, the foreign headquarters wants to make sure that people on the ground are doing their job, so they want to sort of not just sort of support them, but monitor them. There's also, like, you know, there's just sort of a lack of responsiveness for, you know, for, it's hard to know what you don't know, obviously, if you're really far away. So is the reason why the Eco Lodge hasn't broken ground yet because it's too steep, or because your staff on the ground are lazy, or because the community is still taking a long time to buy in? It's hard to say. So like, those kinds of examples, I think if you, every single organization you saw on the ground would tell you, would give you really obvious things in which they feel like their headquarters abroad are being ridiculous.
Yeah.
Those are their questions. Now, I can't promise that. I can, you know, I mean, I wouldn't say that. I would say that it's not very common. Like, every once in a while, I would say feels like there's some difference between what it looks like from Boston than Rwanda. But that PIH is a really nice model where we all live and work here, and they kind of create a support system, provide financial resources, provide accounting, provide some overall guidelines, send experts occasionally, but they serve kind of as a support entity, an advising entity, and not like, they don't draft, you know, they don't manage from abroad. I don't know. Was that helpful right now, or is that seemed a little bit sort of still kind of...
It helps.
Concrete?
I mean, I think it, you know, I'm not totally sure what to do with this, except, you know, except continue. It sounds kind of ridiculous, but continue our, you know, our focus on, we don't know how to gauge this stuff, right? Like, I feel like, it sounds to me like there's good management from the U.S. and bad management from the U.S. because maybe the good management, you wouldn't call it management, you'd call it support and advising only. But, you know, to me, it's like the central organization, it's giving you the money, it's helping you out. It should be helping you to the extent it can. It should be holding you accountable, but it shouldn't be micromanaging you. I don't know what to call that.
Yeah. No, yeah, sorry. I agree. I wasn't trying to say, you know, my advice would be, you know, what to take from that, I think, is, yeah, this is why what you're doing is great. And I do think I don't mean to be too cynical. I guess I'm saying is, you know, you see those, where those things go wrong. And so, no, it's really great to see organizations like, you know, your review of the Carter Center, and I think your review of PSI, you know, becomes, you know, you know what you're doing is what I think is, I personally think is much needed, which is not focusing on the narrative for what their mission is, because all these organizations have really good narratives to tell a really good story for why they're trying to go. And the story is the easy part, but, you know, trying to measure it. No, I'm sorry. I don't really mean to say that they can't be any good at all, or that you should be doing. I think that's kind of the whole point. So yeah, no, I think it's great. I think so that there are more bad organizations, there are more not particularly effective organizations, or there are more organizations that could be a lot more effective than they are, but there are obviously some organizations that take what they do really seriously and are monitoring what they do really seriously and that kind of stuff. So, I wish I could give you concrete examples of maybe questions that you could both ask and answer for, like, the Carter Center. But when I just look at it, I think, okay, this, you're taking the data that they've provided. It makes sense. With the best information you have, you're kind of what the impacts are, and it looks, they have a mission, and it looks like they're accomplishing their mission to a large extent, which is great.
This might be a good time. Hang on a second, I'll just write this down. This might be a good time to go into two of the charities you work on that I have questions about. I mean, Partners in Health, as you know, is a recommended organization from GiveWell. That's largely on the basis, I mean, partly it's on the basis of the reputation and I think the model. The model is a huge part of why we recommend Partners in Health, because it's focused. Because it's, doing something that we feel, since people are on the ground and they're living there, they're up close, they're able to see what's going wrong, and it seems like as long as it's a fairly simple model from an organization level where there aren't, 4 million different projects, that the goal is to provide primary care in these community health centers. So, we largely think as long as this stuff is being done competently and not ridiculously, it'll be improving lives, which is not true of a lot of the more, vertical stuff. So that's why I recommend it. Right. But another reason we recommend Partners in Health has to do with this report that we saw when we were first evaluating them. And that report was very specific about what the money's getting spent on, what the plan is, who's doing what, and implied that there was going to be continual updates of this nature and this sort of progress. However, the report's not public. We're not clear to make it public. And this is now, we're now talking about a year and a half since we said, hey, we've got this report, can we make it public? And the answer was no, and, we're going to, the Clinton Foundation publishes it. Well, the Clinton Foundation doesn't seem to have published it. We can't find it anywhere. So this original report is not public. Meanwhile, we only have it because we had Partners in Health apply for a grant, and they sent it to us, and even sort of, it's not anything. They gave us permission to cite it, but there was some noise about it. So now we look at the Partners in Health website, and like, man, if I were just starting from nothing and looking at the Partners in Health website, I wouldn't have much to say except that there's not any substantive information on that website, or there's very little. We don't have anything public. We don't have an update on the report, and we don't have anything on that website that really tells us what's going on. And so I am starting to worry with Partners in Health about quality control. So the Haiti place has a very good reputation, I know you working in Rwanda, but that's kind of random that I know you. And then in these other areas, Sotho and whatever, who knows? Maybe things are a disaster over there and nobody's reporting on it, nobody's measuring anything. So it's all these concerns that I don't know what to do from here,
let me respond. No, I totally understand what you're saying. For what it's worth, I think you can rest assured that the PAH isn't backpedaling on that document. Essentially, what that document was turned into a national model through the Clinton Foundation, and turned into not a PAH document for what they call the rural healthcare scale up or something like that, but be turned into a Ministry of Health document. So now the Ministry of Health has a document for its model for scaling up healthcare that's no longer a PIH document. And it has ideas. This is largely with the support of the Clinton Foundation, administrative support. And so what they did is they surveyed all of the entire health system, all the health clinics and hospitals, figured exactly where they were. And then based on a great deal of guidance from PIH, but also, of course, a lot of guidance and support from the Ministry of Health, came up with a model that they're doing. Now they've produced these sort of essentially a healthcare model for every district based on what you read a year and a half ago in Rwanda. Now, the since then, what PIH has specifically done for its own management, and this is true for Rwanda, Lesotho, Malawi, I don't know about Haiti, is we've been working with, I think I sent you this information, but with the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, they gave us a $150,000 grant to write a proposal for a bigger grant for a comprehensive monitoring strategy. So we've hired a new director of monitoring and evaluation who's been working with us for about, I guess he's been working with us for about 6 months now. And we're hiring, we've had a director of monitoring and evaluation in Rwanda who's been new. Actually, we'll have a new one. She was working on a volunteer basis, but we're having a full-time person appointed in the next few months, be conditional on this grant that's coming through. But we've actually, like, we've done a lot of work, very serious work, and work that will probably amount to real data once we get this grant, because, you know, we need the money to collect the data. But we've been working with the not only the Ministry of Health, but the National Institute of Statistics, in particular for schemes of being able to collect population health data, in addition to sort of like all the sort of like health, like the site-specific stuff. So we have a design for surveying a population of about 4,500 households, 1,500 in three districts. We actually won't do the survey. The National Institute of Statistics will do it as part of their five-year demographic and health survey, but they're going to expand the survey site so we have a representative sample. And they're going to ask additional questions that we've come up together that have to do with some other factors, like some other health questions and some other economic questions. So they're doing that the beginning of 2000. This is not a baseline for everywhere we work, but we're trying to expand to, we want to expand to 13 new health centers. So it'll be a baseline for those 13 new health centers. But it'll also give us sort of a cross-section between three districts, some where PIH is operating now and some where we're not operating. And somewhere, you know, some have different sort of levels of support. And so we can use both the 2010 data to sort of try to get some measurement of the impact on population health of the programs and, of course, access and everything else. But then it's supposed to happen again in 2015. So that's part of, like, so I guess my point is that, so that document that you saw hasn't sort of gone away and we've hidden behind it. It's that it's been sort of actually implemented, but it really taken up by the Ministry of Health. And simultaneously, we've been working on another M&E campaign that's been, you know, fortunately through, I mean, you know, getting grants.
So that's grant all
to do it, but we're taking it seriously. We're taking M&E seriously. Right. We're slow, obviously, like all the other organizations, but
I mean that's good to hear it. It sounds good, but I also have to say that, you know, getting a good sounding plan about evaluation is not rare in the charity world, and what is rare is seeing the output. And so it concerns me that you got a document, you know, the Ministry of Health is using it and got this plan, but none of it's public. We can't see any of it, and we can't see any the output, and so you know, I don't know, given what we know, if we're going to recommend Partners in Health for this go-around again. And in the future, if this Doris Duke thing comes through, and the M&E gets done and published, and, you know, then we'd recommend them again. I don't know what's going to happen this year. I have to think hard about it, because I think in the end, I probably still would bet on Partners in Health, but I'm getting iffier and iffier on it until I see actual public data, and it doesn't feel fair to kind of be taking your word on, you know, on how things are going when we could be doing the same for many other organizations. And, you know, our general standard is not to take someone's word, it's to look for the data.
Of course. So how valuable would it be to you to see the specific
not that
plan
valuable.
For the M&E?
I don't know.
Like that's a draft,
I would be
valuable.
Interested, but I don't think it would influence us much. I think it's more like one thing that would definitely be valuable to us would be to see for the three areas in Africa. There's three, right? Rwanda, Lesotho, and I forget the other one. But Malawi. Okay. To see Malawi. For those three and really for all the other programs too, like, you know, what's happened in the last year, and that doesn't have to be health survey and health impact, but even just the level of, you know, monitoring, not evaluation, but what's the money been spent on, who's been treated for what at level, and how was that verified, and what was the quality control on making sure those treatments were done correctly. That's something that,
right,
that something would help us a lot. I mean, right, then I think we...
Let me look into that. So we've been sort of pushing this really hard, but we have electronic medical records that we're sort of trying to advance the technology to do it cheaply, et cetera. Yep. And we do have sort of weekly reports that are automated from the electronic medical records that go to Boston. And I can at least look, I could look into to see what they do with those reports and whether they make those public.
Okay, so that's Partners in Health. Millennium Villages, I mean, all we can really say about Millennium Villages right now is that it looks like all the data is pretty much baseline data. It looks like it's kind of scattered, but not a lot of, not what we would call outcomes data, and I wouldn't call MVP a proven model. I think it's a model that is hoping to become proven. And so at this point, and I think you would probably agree with this, but we'll see.
Right.
You know, I wouldn't recommend MVP at this point to Mr. like naive, you know, I have $1,000 guy, because I wouldn't call this a proven model that needs scaling up. I would call this an experiment that's hoping to become that sort of a thing.
Yeah. That's right. That is definitely what it is. I mean, that one key difference between the Millennium Villages project and maybe some of these others is that even though the staff are people who've been in the business for a really long time, it's not like it has a bunch of amateurs. The organization itself and the way that they're doing it, you know, is really young. And so it started off as an idea. So there are, so they should be, see, with the, you should be able to get, I don't know if you ever saw the baseline data for the Sowry Kenya Millennium Villages Project site, but they have a really, really good baseline report from Sowry Kenya that's very comprehensive. That okay, and so the update, I don't know when they're going to have the update, but they should have like a midterm one. They, you know, they do these, they do like a, the plan was to have two really big surveys, in year one and year five, and a midterm survey, which is still pretty good, that should be available soon. So I don't know. You know, their biggest problem in my mind for M&E is that they were a little bit ambitious. They had the opposite problem. They were really, really focused on M&E, and they were over ambitious with the amount of data that they could collect and process. So they got so bogged down in managing all that data that that analyzing it has been in 10 countries at 12 sites. So it's been that's been their single biggest issue.
I can't help but notice that you're never mind, no, that's right. I forgot which was the order, but you used to be with MVP, now you're with Partners in Health, right? Yeah.
Right. I used to be, technically, I was with the Earth Institute.
Right. I understand.
I didn't have an official point.
Now you're officially Partners in Health.
That was the project I did. Yeah. Well, actually, officially, I guess officially, I'm at Harvard. And I don't know. I have a PIH email address. In addition to a Harvard email address. But I'm not on the PIH payroll or anything like that.
So, all right.
So I could talk trash about PIH, and I would still be able to keep my job for 2.5 years.
All right. So moving on. I mean, I guess the last thing I'd like to talk with you about is just the, you know, what the future looks like, what our approach looks like, what we're thinking. So we wrote it up briefly at our research agenda, but you know, basically, we've got kind of two sides to our research. One is doing kind of like reviewing the academic literature, trying to get a handle on some general questions like what's the track record of aid, what's worked, what hasn't worked. We've been making blog posts on these issues that I can send you, and we've got some gaps in it. So I don't know if this is the kind of thing you could help with, but you know, we wish we had more comprehensive sources of the big success stories in international aid, and wish we had better data on this and that. So I can send you a list of things we're looking for if that's something you think you could help.
Do you post? Do you have a link of other efforts to do what you're doing? There must be a couple there that, you know, are out there evaluating performance of, you know, health intervention or poverty reduction programs?
At the charity level, like the closest thing is the UPenn Center for High Impact Philanthropy, where they, you know, but they kind of look more at a particular program of a charity. They don't evaluate, like, the whole charity, you know? And then at the, you know, there are a lot of, well, there, not a lot, a lot. There's, like, one or two other sources of information on what programs work. So we do have a list of those, and you know, basically the big ones. I mean, there's this publication by the Center for Global Development called Million Saved, Successes in Global Health, and that's like a list of success stories that everyone's always citing as the list of success stories in international aid. So, you know, the what's worked, what hasn't question. We use them. We use Poverty Action Lab, Innovators for Poverty Action, and the Copenhagen Consensus. Also, I all have their views on what works and or what's cost effective. Also, the Disease Control Priorities Project. So I don't know. Is that the question you were asking? Yeah, and we're looking for more, though. So I just named all the big ones. And, you know, we also use Copenhagen reviews.
Right. I mean, tell me if I'm right, but this the way I interpret everything about what you all do is sort of like everything is, it's, well, I mean, maybe this is obvious. It's like it's in the constant state of reflection. So it's, so you're not only sort of asking questions, like trying to answer some questions, but you're constantly asking, you know, are these the right questions to ask? You know, there's a feel in many ways of like, of, you know, you're reaching your tentacles out sort of far, sort of trying different kinds of ways to just how to collect certain kinds of information, how to evaluate different places, and sort of trying to slowly shape a good, I don't know what you'd call it, but, you know, platform or strategy for all of this. So it seems to me that you're still working on, in some cases, like what
well,
are
we
the
always
right
are. Yeah, I mean, I think it sounds like what you just said is that we're, you know, we're always being reflective about our process, and we never just barrel ahead with what we've decided is the right process. So that's true. That's largely what I'm asking about.
Right.
And, you know, that's why I'm trying to kind of constantly have these conversations where we're just always telling people, all right, this is what we're up to. This is our plan. You know, what do you think? Are we missing any good sources of information? You know, is this a good path to go down to accomplish our goal and just get lots of perspectives on it? So going back to it, sorry, were you going to ask something? We've got this kind of, you know, this academic literature search on what's worked, what hasn't worked, you know, some other miscellaneous questions, what are the potential harms of aid, and, you know, so we're doing that, and I can send you our work on that and our remaining questions. And then on the other side, we're looking for good charities. And we're doing it pretty differently from last year, where instead of starting with a big, broad grant application, which ends up wasting a lot of people's time, we're scanning charities' websites, and we're asking two questions. One question is, what programs do they work on? What are their programs? And are those programs sort of all or nearly all in the list of what we consider to be good programs? And so the list of good programs is taken from the academic literature and mostly consists of health programs, health initiatives, because those seem to be the things that have a track record, whereas things like microfinance and agricultural interventions, frankly, don't seem to have much of a track record. And then there's like a few education programs that have been tested by the Poverty Action Lab, but they tend to be pretty narrow. So, you know, tends to be mostly health stuff, you know, with some education. And we are interested in the economic stuff too, but we ask, you know, are they doing mostly programs that are on our list, or are they kind of one of these big, huge, broad organizations that does everything? Or are they doing, you know, stuff that's really not on our list, stuff that really has no track record? That's one question we ask. And then the other question we ask is, do they publicly make available data on how things are going? And we have a pretty low bar for that for the first cut. But, you know, basically, are they giving us some kind of technical report on how they assessed in a systematic way, not anecdotal, how things are going? So we look for charities that kind of meet one of those two criteria. I would say Partners in Health meets kind of the first one. It's focused. It's doing kind of, it kind of does one thing, maybe two things, and we approve of them. But there's no, you know, there's no data on how things are going. And the Carter Center, I think, both of those criteria, sort of, although it has some programs yeah. that are iffy. So we look for those, and then we take, you know, we kind of go in order of which one seems strongest, and we go deep on them the way we did on the Carter Center, and we actually just finished another one, the Stop Tuberculosis Partnership. And we're looking for the best charities kind of by those two criteria. They're doing something that's a good idea, and they're showing that it works. And as one more random observation, well, let me pause there, and then I'll give you the random observation. I mean, you know, general process, thoughts.
Yeah, I wonder, you know, whether one thing you haven't said is anything about visiting the sites. And I know right. that becomes really tricky because you can't visit all of the sites. And so, you know, once you visit one site, then suddenly, right. you know, you have a bunch of more information on one than the others. But I feel like there are really general lessons that you could learn about visiting a site. You know, one is the difference yep. between what you expected from their website and their data versus what, you know, you learned on the ground. And there are, you know, for example, I mean, if you were just in Rwanda, for example, you could easily go from, you know, some, you know, PIH to the Millennium Villages Project to, you know, there are a gazillion smaller organizations. We've got two education yeah. NGOs that are working in our district alone. It could, and you know, I have these mixed feelings. So I think what you would find, if, for example, if you visit PIH, is you would say, you know, oh my God, I can't believe how hardcore this, I'm just saying this in all honesty, this organization, I mean, you know, just the sort of the, if nothing else, the visual effect or the personal effect of being around a, you know, a hospital and some clinics with, you know, hundreds of health workers out there who are training and going out in the community, yep. et cetera. You know, it's really obvious that there's a lot going on. And then you'd be stuck with two questions, which is, well, you know, on the one hand, it seems like a shame to discount people because what they do is hard to measure. But on the other hand, obviously, you yep. can't evaluate things without having data, you know. And so that latter part's obviously really important. And so, but it seems like I really think you would have you'd get a lot out of somehow coming up with a process of determining some sites to visit that maybe sort of geographically close to each other or something like that, and just, you know,
yeah, I think
visiting, just seeing what they're doing.
I think you're right.
Really get a lot.
It's something
out of
that we want to do. I think it. I'm trying to think where it goes in the process, because the issue you mentioned with practicality is a big one, which is that, you know, we're trying to cut through to the best organizations. We can't do that for every organization, and furthermore, I am afraid that any look I got, especially as like a donor or evaluator, would be, you know, less than representative. So, you know, I think where I want to put this in the process right. is I want to kind of like do our report, come up with our guesses based on the data, and then sort of do it as a reality check at the end, you know, and come in and go to some of the ones we think are the best and see how that checks with our theory, and then maybe visit some nearby too and see how that works. So I think it's very likely that I would do exactly what you proposed and kind of see, you know, some of the bigger names that work on a community basis. So MVP and PIH being, you know, two of the big contenders, and then maybe a couple random ones too. I think, you know, is something I want to do. It's a question of when do we allocate that time and how do we choose the organizations? And I think the answer is, you know, at the end when we're no longer struggling to meet a deadline for this report anyway. And we have, you know, we have our guess as to who's worth checking out.
Right. 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 Yeah. I mean, in terms of like the questions that your criteria for valuing their website, I don't have any strong opinion about that. I mean, I do. I guess I would say like. I mean, you know, my heart goes out to you in terms of like the scope yeah. of what you're trying to accomplish, you know? And so you just have so much, there's so much you're trying to do, and you're sort of leaning down, you're trying to be as sort of, you know, try to use criteria that work, and it seems to me like those are, that sound like a lot of good rules of thumb. And so, you know, scanning people's websites and stuff, I don't know what you do with organizations that seem like they're a lot more effective than what they've been able to document, but I like personally that you offer a lot of incentives to collect better data. And all organizations should be collecting better data. PIH should be collecting better data. Obviously, it's what they do is hard to monitor in some ways, but in some ways, you know, they could be a little bit more on top of that in the first place. So, you know, and there's no reason why I don't think some of that information, I don't think there's no reason why some more information just couldn't be made.
Yeah, public. I think I can tell you what we're doing. I mean, basically the approach is go to the website. If someone's doing good programs, like programs that in general we think are good, but they don't have any data, that's when we would kind of push them a little more, get in touch with them, see if we can make something of it. You know, and then, but then the basic idea is to just publish our recommendations, you know, make those recommendations as impactful as we can and leave the door open to organizations that can improve. And so, you know, we sort of think we're not a capacity builder, we're a carrot. And we're trying to say, you know, for Joe on the street with $1,000, he should be giving to the ones, to the organizations that have sort of already made it, that are, you know, not the ones that have potential, the ones that are good, the ones that are proven. And then other guys have that goal to reach to get that same reward.
Can I mention, I would like to mention a small charity, or whatever you call it, organization that I would be curious how you would evaluate. So my partner, Molly, works for this organization in New York City called Just Food, and their focus is on essentially, you know, you call it food justice in areas, food justice. So their focus is on getting access to high quality food, or at least, you know, in poor areas like in the Bronx and stuff, right? So that's through urban gardens and through actually some of its policy stuff, making sure the farm bill allows for food stamps, that markets, you know, that they try to sort of secure space that, you know, for they do a lot of training models so they can get people growing a lot more food in whatever spaces that are available. And, you know, that's an organization where you would say, you might say, I don't quite totally get like the long run vision of this, but when you're with, it's an organization that at a visceral level you can tell it's extremely lean. It's like the right size. It's very effective. They train trainers. They, you know, they're extremely involved in the communities in which they operate, and it just feels right. You know, it's hard to explain that, you know? And I'm curious, like, if you looked at their website and you know, and saw what they're up to, it's kind of an activist organization, but they have, you know, deliverables, you know? They secure sources to produce food, and you know, my partner, for example, worked at one urban garden in Red Hook, and they would get like 80% of their proceeds of the markets were food stamps in front of a retirement community and stuff. And so they were getting high quality fresh food into places that what they were otherwise called food deserts, areas that have really high rates of diabetes because people are doing their grocery shopping at like their corner store because there isn't a grocery store for a couple of miles, you know. So those are subtle kinds of things. They're kind of activists, but they're also some deliverables. I wonder, that's the organization that at its scale has been the best, it's been the most impressive organization I feel like I've known in terms of like the overall sort of spirit and like focus of an organization. And I don't know how on earth, and yet it, you know, fits with broadly with what I wonder, maybe it doesn't fit with it's an American organization. Yeah. Maybe it wouldn't do what you would do. Yeah, but it's such a good one, and like there are small. I don't know a lot of small NGOs in Rwanda that I think seem great, but there are some ones that are trying stuff, you know. But I'm just curious what you do with these organizations that look like. I was just thinking about one as like, well. This is a great organization.
Well,
how would you evaluate that?
I think again, it just comes down to like we have to be clear about our mission, our value added, and not confuse it with, you know, create an objective list of the best charities in the world. That's not our mission.
Right.
That would be impossible.
Right.
It would be impossible to evaluate every organization.
Right.
That's not what we do. what we do is we try to, we ask a question, which is, if you have $1,000 and you're not an engaged donor, you can't get up close on the ground, you want kind of a commodity charity, what can you give to? And that's, you know, the analogy I would use is that if you're local to an area, you probably get your coffee at the local place that no one's heard of. But if you're in a totally foreign place and you just need a good cup of coffee, you should probably go to Starbucks.
Right.
And that's, you know, that's who we're trying to right. serve is we're trying to take yeah. people, which is an enormous amount of money, which is people sitting there with, you know, without a special connection to a charity, but who have some money to give away and say, these guys are good, these guys are proven. So it's a different mission from finding the best charities.
Right.
And the thing that would kill us is staying up right. at night
sure.
worrying about every great charity that we've missed because they're too hard to measure. That's not our thing. We think that, right. you know, charities that are great but too hard to measure,
right.
they should be supported by people who see them up close. And then if those people want to grow them, they can try to develop them into the more kind of well-oiled machines that can be publishing evidence of effectiveness on the web. So, I mean, all that said, I mean, you did cite some quantifiable evidence for
right.
for, you know, the organization you're mentioning, for Just Food. Hey, you know, if that was sitting on their website, public, and we could find it, and we saw, wow, you know, this area was one of the high diabetes areas, and, you know, here's some literature on what that means and what that implies, and then we get 80% of the food stamp revenue, and here's the progress of diabetes in that area over time, you know, hey, we might consider that something good, but is this, you know... This is a small organization. Is it an organization where we're going
right.
to publish it on GiveWell.net and say, everyone give your $100 here? Probably not. It's probably at the wrong scale. It probably doesn't have the ability to just keep scaling up the way that some of the larger ones do. And so, again,
right.
you know, goal, we cannot keep ourselves
right.
up worrying about every good organization we've missed. That would be impossible, and it would be a bad goal. The goal is to find, you know, in a sense, commodity charity that works. Find a good option for the grand.
Do you publish the number of donations that are made?
Well, I mean, we can't track that process? Perfectly, but to the extent we can track it, yeah, we do have that info. It is available publicly, although in kind of a weird format, and it is on our list, although kind of low, to make it, you know, more easily accessible. But last two Decembers, about 30 grand went through our website. To our recommended charities, and then that's going to be, you know, that's going to understate it because that's only people who clicked on the donate link on our website and went through the whole network for a good thing, which is kind of a pain.
Yeah.
But that's the stuff that goes through our website, and then then we also have, you know, a few hundred grand in sort of our own money that we give away, and our own money plus giveaway pledges. So,
right. Is that 30 grand? Yeah, I mean, I would think that would be a
yeah.
pretty big understatement because everybody would first go
yeah.
to the website, and that would be the primary way. So, I don't, you know, be curious if you could figure out how much that understates it. But of that 30 grand, do you have do you know
it's like 200.
What the average size of a contribution
like
is? Is it like $100
it's
or
like
$1,000 or
200 is the average,
grand?
And nobody gives nobody gives 15K.
Oh, really?
It, you know,
that's great.
From $20 to $1,000, I'd say. $20 to maybe a couple thousand. That's probably, that seems about right. I can get you
right.
down if you want more of a breakdown.
Huh. Mm. Yeah. Okay. No, I think that's really interesting. And does that just go to the?
Yeah.
Does it?
Yeah.
Does it rank according to?
Yeah.
Your,
I mean, PSI is the biggest one.
Recommendations.
Called,
yeah.
Who gets the money? Yeah. So, I mean, and well, another thing is that GiveWell, you know, we're new, and so we have to do a better job getting the word out and getting the presentation done and all that. You know, the goal is to have that number be, you know, at least 100 times what it is now. But the approach from the beginning is not to connect a small number of donors with a small number of great, small, underlooked charities. That's not the goal. That can't be how we run our organization. The goal is to publish
right.
recommendations that can be used by anyone up to a large amount of money and that are useful to people who aren't on the ground themselves. And so, you
yeah.
know.
One thing that I wonder if you are interested in is toning down a little bit. Let's see if I see it. Let me go back to your top charities link. So essentially what you do is you rank them. And then you assign, and you also, wait, let me just go back and let me confirm that. I think of you as ranking them, but you know, these top three things. But
well, we
I guess you don't technically.
I mean, we list them. Rank. We list them in that order on purpose. You know.
Okay.
You
rank
them.
Okay, I see. Opinion. Yes. Yeah. Right. Would it make? I mean, I don't. I can't tell. But, would it be? Would it be almost more sensible to? I don't know. Maybe that's the way to go. I mean, what would happen if you just said, okay, you know, this is the information we have, this is the publications, we're recommending these things, you know, we're splitting hairs between recommending some of them, here are our finalists, here's what, and so it becomes more of a clearinghouse in which people observe, you know, people who are on your website can essentially take the information that you provide, and maybe you could say through your you know, donation links, essentially rank them according to with their dollars,
well, I think that,
you know, by the information that you provide. And so therefore you're not even trying to steer anybody.
I think that already happens to a large degree. I mean, there's plenty of people who read our stuff and choose to give to PIH. I mean, plenty of it. You know, it's not in any, I can send you the breakdown, but it's not that dominated by PSI, for example. So, you know, that already happens to some degree. I think that what would happen if we took away the ranking is it would just be an information loss. Like it wouldn't make us more useful as a clearinghouse. People who want to come to their own conclusions would easily, you know, they can easily see that we're making our own judgment, and we say that we're making our own judgment, and that they should make their own judgment. So it wouldn't be helpful to them, and it would be hurtful to people who literally have 5 minutes. Just a pure removal.
Yeah, no, I can see that. But is there any advantage to, like, essentially, like, I mean, what you're, I mean, I, again, I'm not, I'm, you know, you're not talking to me to give you advice on the website or anything, but I'm just thinking of, like, something like, essentially, a notch closer to, like, you know, the wiki phenomena where somebody, you know, where there's a dynamic play where, you know, you're this clearinghouse of information. You know, if you could tap into all of the knowledge of people who come on the website and read everything and have their own insights, you know, I mean, you do.
Well, we
want to
do that. I mean, we don't get enough of that feedback right now. One of the things we really want to do, and I would appreciate if you had any ideas on it, is, you know, is find more people like you, and we have a few, but find more people who are, you know, have experience of their own, share opinions of their own. Right now, the people who give through our site are not those people. They're people who do have 5 minutes to give, and they don't know anything. And those are our customers. Those are the people we're ultimately trying to serve. But, you know, would we like the website to reflect more feedback from people with knowledge and opinions of their own? Yeah, we would. And the big thing we need to do right now is seriously find more of those people. You know, I think that's pretty much. So if you have thoughts on how to do that, because one of the tricks is that, you know, the more qualified someone is to give feedback, oftentimes the less available they are to do so. And that's been one of the things we face, that, you know, we want people with great academic credentials commenting on our work, but it's not going to happen usually. I mean, we get like one interview with them, but they're not going to be reading everything and posting all their thoughts. So who is that also has good experience? And we found a few people, but how do we find more? So. And yeah, absolutely. We would factor that into our own thoughts and recommendations, and we would publish all that stuff. And, you know, if we had the data on what people besides us think about our work, we would be publishing it. And again, letting people make their own thing. I mean, I don't think the all things considered GiveWell opinion of the rank, I don't think that's going to go away, because that's a piece of information that some people want. But, you know, we would happy to publish other information alongside it.
Right. Well, yeah. No, I'm enjoying this conversation. I'm thinking about how I could do a better job absorbing what you all have put together and then providing meaningful insight. I mean, the one thing that I can say is that, you know, we have, for example, even this is true at the Millennium Villages Project and it's true at PIH with all these, you know, there's a lot of PhDs running around, a lot of MDs running around, and a lot of people who really do care about the impacts. And then there's still, like, a process for thinking about, well, what are the right ways to measure performance that, you know, you can do that are, you know, effective and stuff like that. So there's like the reason why we don't do a better job is probably twofold. One is because it's not the number one priority. The number one priority is to do the service. And the other reason is, and maybe it's a little bit of a slackness about it, really. But the other reason is just sort of thinking about, well, how can you measure this? I mean, doing population surveys, like going out there and taking blood samples, is a lot of tremendous amount of work, obviously. And just telling you the number of people treat, maybe that's worth something. But that becomes, you know, you can question that. So we're still like in this very real process of, yep, like, okay, how do we measure the impacts of what we do? And, you know, it's amazing how hard that is to do, even with a big grant.
Yeah,
you know?
I agree. What strategy can we follow other than find the ones who have already done it best, recommend them, and again, we're trying to be a carrot, not a capacity builder, because we can't be a capacity builder, and it's again just about having focus about what we do. So, you know, I think that the best way to take what we do and take our research is to say, you know, we're not trying to be all things to all people. We are trying to find the organizations that are already well-documented, well-oiled machines, because those are the ones that a naive donor should give to, one who can't see things up close. And then that provides an incentive and a goal for other charities. And so take our work in that spirit, and how is it, you know, and that's the kind of... So I guess I had one more just kind of general question, which is that one of the things we're noticing is that by our standards, by the standard I just described, we feel like a lot of, not all, but a lot of the strongest organizations are these global health partnerships that are not even so much NGOs as they are kind of, you know, often housed at the WHO, often collaborations between different organizations. And I mean, frankly, it just seems like a different world with some of them, not all of them, in terms of focus and transparency. It just seems like they're playing a totally different game from other NGOs. Like the Stop TB partnership, I mean, they're not a Save the Children, where they do a trillion projects in a trillion places, and they have some generalizations on their website. I mean, they do almost one thing. They have this global drug facility. They get drugs to governments doing TB programs. Most of their funding is that. They do other stuff too, but that's most of their funding. And then, boom, they, you know, they take applications, they do this big external evaluation of meeting the conditionality, and then they just publish those reports of what comes out of that right on their website, right in public. And then they're also monitoring the heck out of TB incidents and TB case treatment success rate, and that's all available publicly. So that's Stop TB. Then there's the Gavi Alliance, which you probably know. And again, they do one thing. I mean, they do a few things, but it's all vaccines. They get the funds to the governments. Then the government has to complete this application. Application goes up on the website in public. Then they do an external data quality audit. Data quality audit goes up on the website in public. Then you got the Global Fund, you know, to fight AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria. I think they're a little more scattered. They're not as focused. But again, it's all sitting there in public. You can tell what they do. So, I don't know. Like, we... Those guys are so good by GiveWell standards. I just wonder if you have any thoughts on them, any caution, any thoughts on why that is, or any thoughts on whether we're doing something wrong in thinking this.
I wish I did. You know, I mean, yeah, the truth is, you're right, is that they're a different ballgame, and so they're actually not the ballgame I know so well. The people there are people like both at the Millennium Villages Project and the Earth Institute, and also here at Harvard and PIH, who dabble with both worlds and spend some time at, you know, with WHO or various UN groups, or help do, you know, guide the, you know, policies for PEPFAR or the Global Fund or something like that. But I actually don't have any, I don't have personally any contact with those worlds, and I don't really have a good sense for.
Yeah.
Whether they're as good
why,
as they
why do you think those worlds are so separate? I'm kind of interpreting this as kind of the official aid world and the private NGO world. Is that right? World.
Right. Yeah, I think so.
Why are they so separate? I mean, I've just struggled with this so much. I mean, all the academic literature, official aid, there's all these official aid guys. Right. You go to the NGOs, and it's just this totally different. They're not answering the same questions. They're not publishing the same info. And generally, I have to say, I mean, from our perspective, they're much more frustrating because they just don't share as much information, and they don't seem as interested in data collection.
Yeah, private NGOs.
You're talking about NGOs. Yeah, that's well. It's so interesting. So, like, I would say that's also true at a social level. Like, you know, here in Rwanda, it's a fairly small expat community, and there are like, there are NGOs who people kind of hang out with each other, and these kind of big international agencies that have bigger buildings and salaries and office spaces and things. It's funny, like, I'm underinformed to be able to say anything smart about this, but I can say for myself, I was introduced to this world once. Again, I should be really careful what I say, but I went to a meeting in Dubai, and the meeting was organized by Dubai royalty, and it was pulling together various organizations from, some people from the UN, some people from their things, and the goal was I don't want to say it because I think this will probably turn into a program, so what I'll say is, because these are, again, people I know and work with, and the goal was to do address a very specific, you know, poverty related problem that is experienced in Africa and the Middle East, right? And what the UN people said, what we need to do is create a new office devoted to this problem, and we'll pull these together. And you know, you had presentations from experts of various fields, and this was like, hands down, without question, the biggest disillusioning experience I'd ever had, where I was like, I couldn't possibly work forever for an organization like this, where the process seemed to me like it was more about the narrative and setting up new offices and telling each other that you knew answers and you knew how to do it. And that's not the same as the Global Fund by any stretch of the imagination, but that it's definitely that kind of the world that you're talking about. And that really is, you get a bunch of consultants and experts together, they collect data and they publish that data. It's so funny because I have the totally opposite feeling that you do. I feel like, I was really surprised how genuinely interested and focused and in touch the people were. It seemed to me that people pulling papers, they put together some ideas, and they said, we know the solution to this particular problem, and here are the reasons why we know the solution. When they didn't, I think, know the solution, and then we say, well, set up an office that's going to be devoted to this, to promoting this particular solution. And I was convinced totally that we hadn't really explored what the answer was. And I said that. I said, well, I don't think we seem like we know the solution. Like, we don't seem to know the solution. Like, the reason why this hasn't been working on the ground yet is because these ideas haven't been really well worked through. And there was such this constant narrative of, we know what the answer is. We just know how to implement it. We just need to figure out how to implement it well. And then the way to implement it well is to get a shitload of money, create an office, a new office, and then do it. But I can tell you, I felt really strongly about this, because this really changed my outlook. Because when I first came on board this world, I thought, you know, my ideal job might be working for something like the UN. You know, they do a lot of really, you know, they're obviously a very international organization. The Millennium Project has a very clear mission to, you know, end poverty or whatever, and does its thing. And this had nothing to do with the Millennium Project, but it was something like, there was this feeling like, God, this is a very strange world of folks. And, you know, that is definitely not true for the Global Fund. The Global Fund is an organization that spends a lot of money on good things, it seems to me. But,
well, I know. So can I just come in and say that, you know, I do say that. I do know what you're saying. I mean, I obviously don't know it in any way, in anything like the way you know it, but I read, I mean, in terms of, like, the problem you're describing, I read a lot of reports from the UN and the World Bank, et cetera, that feel exactly that way to me. Like, right. they're convinced they know how to solve this problem, and all they need is money, and, you know, and a top-down plan, and they try it, it doesn't work, and they never really acknowledge it, and, you know, I know William Easterly does a great job critiquing this stuff, so I agree with all that. But I think, don't you think that's a bit of a, like, a strong generalization, because when, like, that's not what I see in Stop TV. And so it just seems like, you know, it's a huge world, different parts of it look different. So I look at, you know, I look at certain parts of the UN and I see, well, I mean, a good, you know, I look at certain parts of the UN and I see, here's a grand plan, all we need is the money. But then I look at Stop TV and that's not what's going on at all. I look at Stop TV and it's, you know, they're double checking everything they do, and that's exactly why they have all this data, that they, you know, they're very concerned with the operator.
Right. Yeah, you're probably right, and I have a feeling that that's particularly true for really good health programs where you know, there's a really good track record for effective health programs, you know, historically. We've done good work with polio and smallpox and lymphatic filariasis and measles and whooping cough, and there's a real lot of great stories of things working, you know, with some coordinated international efforts. So yeah, so I should be careful. I'm with you. Obviously, some really great international efforts have sort of had the scales effect that you need to eradicate things, for example. There's no doubt about that. So I don't know. So the answer is I don't. I had a small little exposure to, you know, that part of the world that wasn't a health kind of thing. It was something else. And
I think it's worth keeping in mind. I think it's a good point you raise. Like, you see things from some of these, you know, some of these giant organizations that make you wonder. So it's good to keep in mind, and we worry about a little. But I also, you know, I feel like Stop TV. I don't know, I feel like I'm seeing what I want to see from them, so we'll see how it goes. All right, well, that's, I guess I think I've given you a full update on where we are, what we're doing, what we're planning, what we've done, what our questions are, so.
No, I feel like I should, this is really helpful. I feel like, I could do... I hope I can do a better job of helping you think through, some issues that where I might have some expertise. I don't know if I did such a good job during this conversation, but it was nice hearing where your mind is and where questions are going.
Thanks. Did you read any of those blog posts linked from the preview report that kind of deal with the more academic issues? I don't know if you saw those at all.
I don't know. I'm actually on your blog right now, and I have read a couple of these over time, but I haven't read them from the top.
Well,
the bottom. Which issue are you talking about?
I'm talking about that are like the academic issues. There's been one or two since then, but it would be a start. Like the root causes of poverty.
Let me just look at them real quick to refresh.
The one that's entitled "Root Causes of Poverty" is kind of, you know, arguing that we should be helping people instead of worrying too much about the root causes of poverty.
Let me just pull that up so I can see it. So, this is on.
It's under here. Hang on, I'm going to chat it to you.
So I kind of have to.
So that page links to the blog post we're talking about under the heading Key Issues in Aid. And it's really the first two that are kind of, you know, the ones we want feedback on that we might be missing some information on.
So I just pulled that up. And so I just see this thing. This is the preview report, which I've been to this page a number of times. So you're saying, the case against root causes,
and also the AIDS.
Let's see if I've read that. I don't know. I skimmed this a while ago.
Nothing. I just want to know
so
if you had any thoughts
what was
on
your
it.
Question?
This is kind of something we only discussed charity reports and not the academic side, so I didn't know if that's the kind of thing you're interested in or that you have thoughts on, but I want to make sure you're aware that that's happening too and sharing any thoughts you have.
Okay. I should go back to this. This is kind of my primary focus is this root cause of poverty, and I kind of basically have taken on the side of, you could say, the Jeff Sachs type, but have been really cautious about that, and I'm very sympathetic to, like, these Easterly arguments, and I'm increasingly sympathetic to them, actually.
I mean, it's good to keep in mind, again, GiveWell, just always keep in mind, you know, that we're not trying to be all things to all people, and so, you know, for example, with Sachs versus Easterly, I don't think that I have to take Easterly's side in that debate to take his side for what we do. In other words, you know, you could simultaneously believe that Jeff Sachs is correct in that debate, that what we need is to say and have a giant international, you know, global plan, but you could also believe that, again, for Joe giving $1,000, that's not very useful to him, and what he should be worrying about is more the Easterly question of how do you improve a life. So that's kind of the position.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I would think, you know, you know, to be honest, both Sachs and Easterly would say,
GiveWell,
you know, just trying to rate charities or those kinds of things, kind of like what we both agree needs to. That's part of the whole searcher thing that Easterly's into. So, you know, Easterly's not against people.
I know,
Easterly's not against charity, you know. There are economists who are, you know, as you know, But he's not one.
So when we say don't worry about root causes, we're not saying one should be finding the root causes of poverty. We're saying that individual donors should not be worrying about that because no one knows right now what the root causes are, and individuals should be worrying about helping individuals.
No, I agree. You know, it's we could talk about this forever as well, but I think about this a lot, you know, and it's just this is a little bit of a tangent, but when you live in a place like Rwanda and you're surrounded by a certain amount of real, you know, extreme poverty and even, you know, a fair amount of moderate poverty. Like we have, for example, a housekeeper who I would call poor, and we have a guard at our house who is also poor, and we have several of them actually. And when we think about the scope, you know, I'm on a soccer team, and most of the people on my soccer team are poor, and you know, and every day someone says, you know, can I have school fees or whatever. And so my partner and I have talked a lot about, like, what's the scope of which we make contributions? And we face the same stuff, the same problems you face, which is, well, I could offer money to the captain of my soccer team's brother for his university, but the truth is I don't even know his brother, and I barely know the captain of my soccer team. So it's like to have any sense of whether, you know, that so-called tuition would get to where we want it to go, even for someone I know, but not very well. Like, that's like, you know, like understanding the reach of like trying to do well is actually it's an amazing challenge. You know, you can't always just, you know, you can't just hand out money to anything that you want. You kind of have to know what you're doing. And so some of these charities are doing like a lot of the legwork and said, okay, well, we're on the ground. We're figuring out how we can channel that money. But I mean, I know that's a little bit of an aside, but you know, just the question of, you know, if you're spending money, is it going to go to what you think it's going to go to, and is that going to do any good? Is you know, it's a really simple question. It's really useful, you know. So yeah, you don't have to answer the root cause of poverty. I think you know, if you're spending money, is it going to where you're
spending? Are you on our research email list? Because maybe you should be. That's the easiest way. I mean, that's the easiest way to just make sure you're getting all the new stuff. Anyway. I'll send you the link.
How do I get on that list?
I'll sign up here.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I mean, I'm constantly thinking of, I mean, I just think this challenge of being able to put your money effectively where you want to is really an amazing challenge, even at the smallest scale.
Yep.
that you can think of. You know, like, you know, we gave a mortgage to our housekeeper recently, which is it's $1,000. So it's $1,000, 15-month mortgage. He's paying us back, you know. And that's really easy because he's, like, really, really responsible. We know exactly what he's doing. And we have other little opportunities like that, like, you know, helping someone go to university, you know, one of our guards. And we know him really well, too. And, you know, we've seen him study really well and all this other stuff. But even that, is like, you know, you have to pay attention to what, you know, otherwise there's something, I do believe that the money can be, somehow be wasted or create perverse incentives or a strange dynamic, you know, and that it's not always good just to, you know, even if you know people or, so it's amazing. So then you extend that when you talk about a charity or really a particular noble cause, that's a, you know, an ocean away. And yet there are organizations that are doing a lot of good.
Yep. Yeah, I agree.
Okay.
So anyway, so that's that's all the issues that I've got. I'm just trying to keep you apprised of everything we're doing, and you know, so I got your thoughts, and so appreciate it.
Cool. Yeah, I'm sorry. You know, I'll try to hope I was at least a little bit helpful, and I'll try to stay a little bit more in tune, so we can.
All right, great. Thanks a lot, Matt, and I'll keep keep talking to you.
All right, good luck.
All right, have a good day.
All right. All right. Thank you.